on the case of Caterpillar Logistics against Solas. Mr. Clark.
Your Honor, may it please the Court, Brent Clark on behalf of Petitioner Caterpillar Logistics. This case involves OSHA's injury and illness record-keeping standard and the issue of what is the legal standard for finding a musculoskeletal disorder, such as epicondylitis, to be work-related. This is a unique and bizarre case regarding an employee who developed both lateral and medial epicondylitis in both her left and her right arms. Lateral epicondylitis, or tennis elbow, involves the outside of the elbow, whereas medial or golfer's epicondylitis involves the inside of the elbow. It is not in dispute that it is exceedingly rare for any one person to get both medial and lateral epicondylitis in the same arm. But this case doesn't involve that exceedingly rare circumstance. It involves the actually unheard of circumstance where an individual not only has medial and lateral epicondylitis in one arm, but also gets medial and lateral epicondylitis in the left arm. None of the board certified physicians or any of the witnesses who testified in this case had ever seen such a case or even heard of such a case. There are good and sound reasons why the Secretary of Labor never asserted and was scrupulous throughout the litigation in this case of asserting that the left arm or left elbow epicondylitis was not work-related. The reason is that MK, the individual involved, was only diagnosed with the left arm epicondylitis after she had been off work for 3 years.
Now, didn't she say that the pain in the left elbow began before she was off work?
Yes, she did, Your Honor. She did say that, but the medical records, if you look at the uncontroverted facts in terms of her medical records, those demonstrate that when she first reports pain starting in July, referencing it back to June, all the way out through the time that she's off of work, she never once references to her treating physicians that she has pain in her left elbow. And what's absolutely clear is she was not diagnosed with left elbow epicondylitis until after she had been off work. As I indicated, this case involves the OSHA's injury and illness record-keeping standard. And what is the test for determining work-relatedness when you have non-obvious soft tissue musculoskeletal disorders such as epicondylitis? The standard and the regulations are clear that only work-related injuries or illnesses must be recorded on the log. The test that is involved is made clear both by the OSHA record-keeping standard itself and the OSHA Review Commission's recent decision in Home Depot. First, the Secretary concedes and agrees with respondent that the test articulated in Home Depot applies. Home Depot confirms that an exposure at work must be a tangible, discernible cause of the injury or illness.
What does that mean? What does tangible cause mean? It sounds like bureaucratic babble. It's not a medical concept. It's not a legal concept. So what do you understand it to mean?
Well, and I couldn't agree with you more. What I understand it to mean is that there must be clear, direct evidence that an exposure...
Direct evidence has nothing to do with tangibility. Now, of course, it's not your word, so it's hard to blame you, but when administrative agencies put nonsense concepts into their opinions, all sorts of weird things happen.
I agree, Your Honor. What I understand it to mean, and I've been an OSHA lawyer for 25 years, that there must be some direct causal evidence, some factual connection. And where we do get some insight is into the legislative history. What it doesn't mean is that there's a mere possibility that work is the result of the injury.
Okay, so what do you mean by mere possibility? The world of probabilities is arranged on a line from 1.0 to 0.0. What's the difference between a mere possibility and something else?
Well,
how likely is a mere possibility?
Your Honor, I tend to think of it in terms of speculation, whereas it might be, could be, possibly.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Everything might be, could be, right? There could be a 9.0 moment magnitude earthquake in Chicago this afternoon. But the probability is very low. There are a lot of zeros before the first significant digit, right?
I agree.
So one, lawyers would tend to say that's very unlikely. Well, you know, that's obviously not the dividing line here. If you were going to do this in terms of numbers, what do your words mean in terms of actual probabilities?
In terms of like a percentage, Your Honor?
Yeah.
It's got to be...
This is statistical work. And, in fact, you've even referred to epidemiological studies, right? That talks about statistics. So I'm asking you to do this in numbers rather than words.
Your Honor, if I have to interpret everything, I believe it's got to be in the range of 10 or more percent of the evidence that makes it more than a mere possibility.
All right. So your view then is, if there's more than a 10% chance that something is attributable to work, it should go on the log. And if it's less than a 10% chance, it shouldn't go on the log.
Giving life to the words tangible,
right,
discernible,
now,
yes.
Was there some way from this record that the agency could draw that line? Because it certainly in the briefs, everybody is talking in generalities like probable and speculation. And right, was there any effort to estimate real likelihoods?
The fact of the matter is, Your Honor, that none of them were capable of doing so. That's part of the problem with this case, because it is so unique and bizarre. No individual...
I don't know whether no one is capable of doing so. You've got many years of experience with the workers on this sorting and packing line. How many person years of experience do you have?
Your Honor, the line has been in place for about 20 years. There are anywhere from 13 to 15 workers a year. The number is extraordinary. And to go where, Your Honor,
sounds like 300 person years of experience.
Okay, right? And then if you take...
Now, what percentage of people in the general population suffer epicondylitis in any given year?
Generally about 2%. That's what the record...
Generally about 2%. So you're 0 for 300 at your workplace. Is that statistically significant or not compared to 2%? We want to know whether the probability is being enhanced by working on this packing and production line.
I would say that that is statistically significant, and it was one
is
of the factors...
off the top of your head, or has somebody done the work needed to say whether it's statistically significant?
Absolutely off the top of my head, Your Honor.
That's part of my problem. We've got lawyers talk on your side and lawyers talk on the other side, and then lawyers talk in the administrative decisions when what we've got is a problem in statistics.
And I understand, Your Honor, and that was the fact that given all the different people, all the different body types, all the different work that's done in the council box job, not one single person before MK came along and developed epicondylitis.
I understand, but I just asked the question, do we learn anything from that in a statistical sense? If you go and ask a statistician, you know, given the percentage of people in the population, 2% a year, you say, who get it, we have 0 for 300 years, 300 person years at this workplace. I mean, first of all, that seems suspicious, right? Unless there's a very high distribution of these outcomes, you would expect in 300-person years there would be 6 cases.
Exactly.
0 cases is suspiciously low. Something's wrong.
Well,
anyway, you would want somebody who could do the statistical work to actually do it in a professional way. It seems nobody has done it.
And I agree, and that's a failure on this record. In fact, Your Honor, There is a self-selection process that may help explain. Well, the general population would include the frail, the weak, anyone who happens to be walking around. Those who work at a Caterpillar logistics facility, by definition, are material handlers. So there may, or the explanation may be found in the fact that we're not just pulling from the general population. In some sense, we are beginning to get into the alpha male, alpha female subset.
Well, maybe, but of course it's not called tennis elbow or golf elbow for nothing. It suggests that it's more common in the athletically fit.
I
don't know whether that's true. Again, this is I'm lawyer engaged in lawyers talk.
It is. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I said I was shocked.
Judge Bauer is shocked.
Yes. But there are unique activities that golfers and
he thought I would be reciting T statistics to you.
Your Honors, to get back to the fundamental belief, the legal standard is not mere possibility. That's clear. It's got to be tangible, discernible. However we define that, it's got to be something meaningful. What's more is it's not the employer's burden of proof here. It's the secretary's burden of proof to actually establish that. So the failure in the record with respect to statistical evidence, I would suggest, points directly at the secretary. The judge, in rendering his decision here, made such an emphasis with respect to Caterpillar's failure to identify and prove a non-occupational cause. It's our belief that, in effect, what he did is he shifted the burden of proof to us. The one thing that's clear about the law is we do not have the burden of proof. If Caterpillar were to have offered no evidence, if the secretary fails to show a tangible, discernible cause, then Caterpillar is entitled to judgment. And we believe that that's what happened here. Our second argument, Your Honor, relates to our belief that the decision is not supported by substantial evidence. In this regard, we concede that we have a heavy burden and that the judge is entitled to great deference regarding his credibility determinations. Further, if you look at just the way the judge crafted his decision, it appears there's a logical story to be told. If this were just the case on the four corners of the decision, then Caterpillar would have a very difficult argument before you today. However, this case involves the 13th and the 14th chimes on a clock. Until you consider what the judge plainly ignored, everything makes sense. But once you consider the uncontroverted evidence he did ignore, it is like the 13th and 14th chimes. Not only are those chimes wrong in and of themselves, but they undermine and indict everything that comes before. The first critical failure we would like to discuss in argument today, Your Honor, is the judge's failure to consider and evaluate the testimony of Howard Edwards. One thing certain about this bizarre case, the case involves the failure of Caterpillar to record MK's lateral and medial right elbow epicondylitis on the log.
But may I ask you, with regard to Mr. Edwards, did he testify that all three factors, force, posture, and repetition, have to be present in order for there to be a risk of epicondylitis?
In some degree, he did, Your Honor.
Okay, and so yes, that's contradicted by Dr. Covert, right?
That is, it's generally contradicted, but if you read the AMA guidelines, they show strong correlations between force and repetition, force and awkward posture.
But the AMA guidelines don't identify those. All three must be present associate the risk of epicondylitis.
That's correct, Your Honor. Now, with respect to Mr. Edwards, he is the decision maker in the case. The one thing that's unique about him, ironically, he used to be OSHA's ergonomic expert before he came and worked at Caterpillar. He's also trained in the record-keeping standard, but this is the most critical of all. Of all the folks involved in evaluating this job, Mr. Edwards had actually done all the tasks involved in the job. So he was the one individual uniquely situated to be able to say, this is the force in holding the gun. This is the force in putting the material into the box.
What does that have to do with anything?
Because we're talking about an evaluation of whether that job requires excessive force, excessive awkward postures.
No, I don't see why anything has to do with whether something is excessive or not. The question is simply one of causation. Does doing these things increase in your percent, you know, given your evaluation, does doing these things increase by 10% the probability of getting epicondylitis? Now, whether something is excessive doesn't help answer that question.
Your Honor, forget the word excessive. He was the one uniquely positioned to determine
what the job was, but does he know what the link between that and epicondylitis is?
Yes, he was intimately familiar with the factors and the general literature, which all identify forced repetition and
output pressure. But he was so intimately familiar with it that he erred in saying that all three factors must be present.
Your Honor, I understand he overstated the connection, but that does not undermine his position in his testimony. If you really read his testimony, he very thoroughly understood how the connection was between force, repetition, and awkward postures. The truth is, force is the key factor here, and the AMA guidelines and all the epidemiological literature say that. I see that my time has expired, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Clark.
Thank you.
Ms. Goodman.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Lauren Goodman, and I'm counsel for respondent to the Secretary of Labor. I want to start by addressing your inquiry about the statistical issue, and I, with respect, want to suggest that that puts too fine a point on the question. The record-keeping regulations are designed to be broad. They are not designed to be as precise as calculating a certain percentage of probability that work with a cause of an employee's injury or illness. We're talking about...
So how do you think the line is drawn between what should be put on the log and what shouldn't? You're not going to say it depends on whether it's tangible, because that, as applied to a medical issue, is a complete noise word. It's like a word out of Lewis Carroll's Jabberwocky.
No, I think the idea is that what you want to put on the log is information that is important to both the employer and to the agency and to the public at large in terms of trying to identify trends in injuries and illnesses, trying to identify areas of concern, areas that might be potentially problematic. And I think that the preamble to the final record-keeping regulation makes it very clear.
If what you want to do is use the log as a basis for a statistical study to see whether people in a given occupation get a particular kind of injury, then what the agency should require is that all injuries of people working be listed. Because then you can do a statistical study to identify which jobs are causing the injuries and which job positions are just reporting the norm. But that's not what these regulations require.
Well, I think that in a sense it is what the regulations require. The regulations require that anything with a relationship
exactly the problem. If the reason for having these numbers is to discover whether a particular line of work causes injuries, the only way to do it is to require all injuries to be put in the log. And then you can do a statistical analysis to see whether job X is associated with an increase in the incidence of injury Y.
Well, I tend to agree with you, Your Honor.
Have causation precede the numbers. Well, causation is inferred from numbers.
That's correct. But I think the idea is that you want to keep out of the records things that are not related. So in other words, if you look at the exceptions in the record-keeping regulations themselves, you will see it's situations where the employee was perhaps at the workplace but was there on his own private time for his own private purposes, or a situation in which the employee...
Why wouldn't you put that in, too? You know the phrase going postal, right? Work-related injuries inflicted by angry coworkers are a source of concern.
That's correct. And those are, if you read the preamble, it's very clear. Workplace violence is intended to be covered. The agency does not draw a line between tasks that are related to the job itself and things that are not related to the job task. The idea is things that happen in the workplace are presumed to be work-related for purposes of OSHA record-keeping. So they give the example of the lightning strike, for example. The employee is at work, gets struck by lightning. That is recordable. because but for the fact that the employee was at work that day, the incident would not have occurred.
You mean there wouldn't have been any lightning, or he wouldn't have been hit?
He would not have been injured. But except by virtue of the fact that he was there.
So they have to report that he was struck with lightning on the job?
That is correct.
Well, that's an interesting kind. What's that supposed to discover? That people will get hit with lightning? Or
lack of lightning rods.
But the idea is that we want the regulations to be broad. We want more rather than fewer injuries to be recorded on the log for purposes of discovering.
Why don't you just say report all injuries?
Because I think the agency's view is that if you have things on there that are not related to the employee being at work for the purpose of being at work, you are going to confuse things. You may muddle up the records to the point that they no longer become meaningful.
That's already been accomplished. I mean, you don't have to work at that. It's fairly well muddled up trying to figure out why you're keeping statistics, and if what you're doing, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, is to determine whether or not this job produces that injury, why not report all injuries that occur on that job, all, without discussing anything else?
Because I do think that that is the concern, that you're going to have situations. Let's say you have an employee working on a job. The employee has a heart condition of some sort, falls dead on the job.
It's fine. You put that in the listing, and you will discover, if the job doesn't cause heart attacks, you'll discover that they appear to be completely random. You do a statistical study. You find that there is no increased incidence of heart attacks at position X. And you now know that job X doesn't increase the risk of heart attacks. But you'll never learn that unless you list every heart attack by every employee in every job all the time. You'll never learn which ones are associated with an increased risk.
Well, I appreciate the court's concern about the substance of the record-keeping regulations, but the bottom line in this case is that it isn't.
It comes back to my starting question, which is if you have cause in some way, strong, weak, or otherwise, going into the making of the listing, how do you determine how much of an increase in probability is enough to require the listing?
I don't think it's a matter of probability, Your Honor. I think it's a matter of reasonableness. I mean, in this case, we have an employee here who had no pain before she started in this particular job. She started the job. After a short time in the job, she started to develop pain in her elbows. The pain was worse when she was at work.
That's fine. Look, that's the line you would take if you had a list everything approach. But Mr. Clark says that 2% of the people per year in the general population develop epicondylitis. Right? So there's a lot of epicondylitis that cannot be traced to the sorting and packing line at Caterpillar Logistics. And how does one know whether the probability of a given person being a given episode being associated with a given job is high enough that it goes in the listing? If the listing is a subset of all things that go wrong with all people.
I'm not sure I followed the inquiry, but the point is that I think... We are generally in agreement, I think, which is that the record-keeping regulations are designed to be broad. The agency wants more rather than less. And to the extent that there is a close case on work-relatedness, the agency encourages the employer to put that case on the log, precisely because it's important for research and information gathering purposes. And, in fact, over-reporting rather than under-reporting...
You're not dealing with my inquiry. I said, if the agency said put everything on the log, that I would understand. It hasn't said that. And this is a line-drawing exercise, and I'm trying to figure out then what the criteria in the regulation for drawing the line are. You deny that it's any kind of statistical criterion. The agency uses words like tangible, which are gibberish. So what are the real criteria employers should be using?
There has to be a rational relationship, I believe, between the injury or illness and the work they did, which I think...
whether it's a rational relationship.
Well, in this case, we had a credible, reasonable expert who testified that he did a very close assessment of the risk factors in this case and found that there were...
No. My question is about the standard to be applied. We can get to your expert later if we're applying the standard, right? But I'm trying to figure out, according to the agency, what standard is the employer supposed to be applying?
It is a very low bar, Your Honor. The work has to be nothing more than a contributing factor. In other words, it has to have just played some role in the development of the condition. And I think that the evidence in this case is very clear that that test has been met. And the judge's finding that the secretary met that burden is supported by substantial evidence in the record, in particular the expert testimony of Dr. Harrison, who looked very closely at the job. He, more than anybody else, including Caterpillar's own personnel, interviewed the employee in question, spent considerable time looking for risk factors in the videotape of this operation, and concluded that in his view...
If you're determined to move from the legal standard to the facts, so, and your time is getting short, so let me ask you then about the facts. One fact that seems to me as an amateur to be significant is, let's suppose it's true that 2% of the adults get epicondylitis in any given year. The Caterpillar Logistics has 300 or 600 person years of experience in this department with zero episodes of epicondylitis. Now, one can argue whether or not that's statistically significant, but it doesn't look like the agency discussed that at all. Isn't that something of a problem?
Discuss the fact that there were no cases in this job?
That's what's being asserted, as I understand it.
Well, Dr. Harrison very clearly addressed that point in his testimony.
Look, I just wish you'd address my question. I said, this is what the employer asserts as a fact. The agency, the ALJ and the commission, seem not to have discussed that fact at all. Isn't that a problem?
I don't believe it is a problem, Your Honor, because the fact that there were zero instances, as you pointed out earlier, is perhaps suggestive of a problem with their record-keeping program. So if anything, perhaps it relates to...
Look, if the ALJ thought it was a problem with their record-keeping program, that zero was too small to be credible, the ALJ might have said that, but didn't. The question I'm asking is just a question about administrative law. Doesn't the agency have to discuss apparently important pieces of evidence?
I agree with you as a general matter, Your Honor. In this instance, I don't believe it would have changed the outcome in light of the fact that the judge credited Dr. Harrison's testimony, and Dr. Harrison testified quite clearly that the fact that there were no other instances did not change the fact that there were risk factors for epicondylitis.
We have a lot of Social Security disability cases where the ALJ will say something like, physician X has examined the claimant and concluded that she could work. I therefore rule against the claimant. And the ALJ ignores contrary evidence submitted by the claimant. And we reverse all of those cases. And we say the ALJ can't ignore the evidence favoring one side and just mention the evidence favoring the other, even if that evidence is substantial. That's the kind of concern I'm expressing here. It looks like the ALJ and the Commission ignored evidence favorable to Caterpillar. Maybe they could have discussed it in a way that showed that it's not as significant as it seemed, but the problem is it was ignored. Now, given what we say in Social Security disability cases, why shouldn't we be saying the same kind of thing here?
I respect your position, Your Honor, but I believe in this case that any such error was plainly harmless. It would have added nothing to the decision in light of Dr. Harrison's very clear testimony that the absence of other cases, particularly in a situation where you have the person responsible for the record-keeping program testifying to criteria for work-relatedness for cases like this, that were significantly more strict than what was called for by any of the other witnesses at the trial.
Position. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Further, Mr. Clark, you have a very brief period.
I think we have the union.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Jokic. Didn't want to cut you out.
What I'd like to do is try to give a little bit of a factual context in this case, because I think the factual context is important. You have an employee who never had problems with her elbows before she went to work at Caterpillar, goes to work at Caterpillar in a specific job for several months, never has any problems with her elbows, goes to work in console pack, and after 6 weeks, which all the doctors agree is about the time it takes epicondylitis to develop, epicondylitis develops. And as she's working in the job and console pack, it gets worse. So finally, after 3 or 4 weeks after the onset of the pain and the soreness, she can't raise her arm high enough to swipe out. And a few days after that, she goes to the nurse and says, my arm is really sore. I use it in a repetitive way. I think it's the job. And it's our view that you can use a lot of different words. I think tangible in this case means, is this something that is significant? And I think discernible is...
Tangible and significant mean completely different things. If the agency meant significant, it should say significant. But it didn't.
I guess...
Look up the word in a dictionary.
Thank you, Your Honor.
See if significant is listed as a synonym for tangible in Roget's.
What I would say, Your Honor, is that I think the point of the regulation is to say to record keepers in general industry in thousands of establishments that if you can look at a situation and see a link between somebody's pain and their work, you should record it. And I think that Your Honor is right that the rule is under-inclusive. But I think that the fact that the rule is somewhat under-inclusive would not affect the validity of studies conducted upon the data collected under that rule. Because if anything, if the rule was a little bit under-inclusive, then the results you would have would be more powerful than if you included all workplace injuries or all injuries that were possibly connected with work and tried to sort it out later.
Boss, I mean, what you're saying now is not the way any professional statistician would reason. I mean, this is a problem in statistical inference, and lawyers aren't professionals in that line of work. But from what I know about it, your proposition, and for that matter, your Ms. Goodman's, is just completely counterproductive to what a statistician would want. You can't first filter data by causation and then use the data to infer causation. Doesn't work.
I would say that as a matter of logic, you should err and collect all of the data that you can. The agency has the problem of promulgating a rule with respect to collection of data that applies to everyone, that applies to three-person business or to businesses of 11 people and to businesses of many thousands of people and to all sorts of people who are not trained in record keeping. And as a consequence, the requirements of the rule are not perfect. But I still think that a rule that says collect everything that you think is related to work or that you can make some sort of link is related to work is a rational way to collect data, even if it is not a perfect way to collect data. Now, in this case, we had doctors who looked at both epidemiology and who looked at the individual. And there was a conflict between the doctors. One who looked at the medical records, interviewed the person, was familiar with the epidemiology, looked at movies of the job, concluded based upon that evidence that it was more likely than not that the risk factors associated with the job caused the epicondylitis. Another came to an opposite conclusion. The judge weighed those two doctors.
If the conditions at this job cause epicondylitis, or at least significantly increase the probability of epicondylitis, why in 300-person years of work in this sorting and packing operation are there zero cases of epicondylitis?
The most likely explanation, Your Honor, is that it's underreported.
That I understand as conceivable. And if the ALJ had said that, that I infer that this number is too low to be believable, and so some error must have happened. If the ALJ had said that, that would be, one might think, dispositive. But the ALJ just ignored it.
Well, I think what the ALJ did is he looked at the way the particular individual in question performed the work and the medical.
Suppose the number had been six. What would we infer?
Six cases?
Yeah. Six cases in 300 person years.
Six cases, is that? That's 2%. It would be, again, I would say, Your Honor, the evidence is that in general academia, that workplace injuries are underreported by a factor of 1/3 to 50%. So I would say six cases over that period of time would be a very significant number. And I would hasten to point out that this is the type of injury where if you're going to do good sort of public health survey, you should go talk to the workers about their job, how they do it, and what their symptoms are. And, of course, that is something that never happened in the job evaluation. Thank you, Your Honor.
Right now, Mr. Clark.
Your Honor, I understand I'm on the court's time, and I'm just simply going to make one point.
I let both of your opposing counsel go over a little, so I'll give you 2 minutes total.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, it is our position that the ALJ's failure to deal with critical, uncontroverted facts that clearly go in Caterpillar's failure undermines the decision and requires reversal. One of the key facts is her development of epicondylitis in the left elbow while she was off work for three months. By definition, whatever she was doing at home, whether it's laundry, pouring milk, or whatever with the left elbow.
That again sounds like lawyer's talk rather than medical knowledge. Did a specialist in the field testify to that belief that when epicondylitis is diagnosed 3 weeks after the end of employment, it couldn't possibly have been caused by or associated with employment?
No. No one testified to that.
One can easily imagine the cause happening while a person is working and the diagnosis happening later.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But
I say one can easily imagine, I say I can, you know, I'm a lawyer. I can imagine this using lawyer think.
Understand.
I don't know whether a physician, a specialist, would agree. But there doesn't seem to be any real medical evidence about this.
What we have is a three-month period. I may have misspoken if I said 3 weeks. It's a three-month period where in that three-month period, by definition, she was doing non-work activities. We do know she had not been diagnosed with activity before she did.
How long does epicondylitis take to resolve itself? If you just rest the affected joint, what's the period?
Yeah, the doctors will tell you it's case by case, but in general, it's a matter of some weeks up until years. That's what you'll hear because you're dealing with an inflammation of the tendon. But just the last point on the left elbow epicondylitis. She was doing something at home that caused her to get and be diagnosed with epicondylitis. And that's the one thing we
know. If it's not possible to be diagnosed with epicondylitis some weeks after it really began at work.
Understood.
That assumes your legal stroke medical position. We have your position. Thank you,
Your Honor. Very much appreciate it.
Case is taken under advisement.